it was like, Lindsay, you know what to do. Surrender every 5 minutes if that's what you've got. So that's what I did. Every 5 minutes when it felt painful, it was, God, this is not what I was expecting. Help me endure it.
Hey, welcome to the Live Like It's True podcast, where we talk through some of the most outlandish stories in the Bible and what it would look like to live like those stories are true. I'm your host, Shannon Popkin, and my hope is that these conversations will inspire you to better know the story, share the story, and live the story. When somebody's being arrested, who's the person with the power? Who seems to be the one in control? Ordinarily, you'd think it was the guy putting the handcuffs on, right? Not the one with his hands behind his back. But when Jesus of Nazareth comes out into the open and faces hundreds of soldiers who are waiting to arrest him, it might look at first glance like he's the one who has just stepped into a trap, but I think by the end of this conversation, you're going to see that even in his arrest, Jesus was completely in control. And at the end of this episode, I'm going to invite you to live like that is true. I am so delighted to have my new friend Lindsay Schott joining me today to talk about the true story of the arrest captured in John chapter 18, 1 through 11. Lindsay and her husband Landon live in the Dallas area with their four kids. You can find links to Lindsay's website, her social media, her book on infertility, and more in our show notes. You're going to want to connect with Lindsay after this conversation. She is just one of those people who you can immediately sense she loves her Bible. But before we get to it, I wanted to tell you about my brand new Live Like It's True workbook. It's a free downloadable resource. You can go grab it at shannonpopkin.com, and it's going to help you work through a lot of the things that we talk about here on the show. I am so excited to get this beautiful resource into your hands. And the second thing I wanted to let you know about is our retelling episode, which will be dropping this Saturday. I'm going to be retelling the Bible story that we're discussing today and encouraging you to do the same. If you're enjoying season two of the podcast, This True Story of Easter, would you consider just taking a couple of minutes to leave a rating and a review? That helps others to find the podcast, and boy, is it encouraging to me. All right, let's jump into our conversation with Lindsay Schott about the true story of the arrest. Lindsay, welcome to Live Like It's True.
Thank you so much, Shane. I'm so excited to be here.
I am so excited to have you. Now, Lindsay, you and I are new friends. We're going to kind of get to know each other. And I always say the best way to make a new friend is to open God's word together and talk through it. But we have a mutual friend, Kelly Needham, who was a guest in season one of the podcast. Now, you and Lindsay are friends through church, right?
Kelly and I have been friends for like 15 years. And so we were connected through like a mutual mentor. We were friends in Houston. Then she moved to Dallas. Then I moved to Dallas, and we've been friends through all that. Yeah.
And now you guys are part of this, what is it called? Women's Teaching Program. I'm in it, and I should know the name of it.
It's had many names, and I still sometimes call it the wrong name, so it's okay.
Oh, I love it. Well, and I get to be part of it this year from afar. And basically, we learn how to teach the Bible and practice on each other, which is so fun.
It's so fun.
And that's how I'm kind of getting to know you. But I wanted to talk to you about this story of Jesus being arrested. And I'm going to share. I had a little mix up with the law. Did not end up going to jail, but I mean, it was pretty scary. So this happened in college, Lindsay. I was a manager at our student center at Liberty University. And I came very close to being arrested, and I was not the kind of girl that you would think of as mixing it up with the law, but it's true. There were police involved, there were detectives, and I was guilty, but not exactly of the crime that I was being investigated for. So I'll give you the short version of the story. Basically, what happened is at the student center, at that point, we would have to close for evening chapel on Sunday evening. So we would have the student center open, we would close, and then we'd open it back up, and nobody was supposed to be in the building during chapel, but I stayed in the building because I had to study for a big test the next day. So I knew it was wrong. You know, I knew that I was breaking the rules. But when we opened back up after chapel, I learned that we had been robbed. We opened the safe, got the money box out, and all the money was gone. So we had to call the police, and they came to question everybody. And they kept saying repeatedly, okay, so when you closed,
all the money was accounted for. And when you opened, it was all missing and nobody was in the building during church, right? Nobody was in the building. I mean, I knew I had not taken that money, but I had been in the building. And so, which was actually really scary at this point because somebody else had been in there robbing the place. You know, he kept saying it. There were like six or seven, these police officers and several of us who worked there in this little tiny office. And he's saying it over and over. And finally, I'm like, can I talk to you for a moment? And my voice is quivering. And he goes, all right, everybody out. And they thought that they had their perpetrator. And it was terrifying. I could have been charged with a felony, kicked out of school, lost my scholarship, a huge, you know, penalty. So end of the story is they caught the real guy, thanks to two of my coworkers. But it was really terrifying thing. And what I want you to notice is, even though I was partly guilty, right? I was partly guilty. I was innocent of this crime, but no way did I want to be arrested for something that I was innocent of. I didn't want to pay somebody else's penalty. I didn't want to be kicked out of school, lose my scholarship. You know, I didn't want a felony. But here in this story that we're going to look at, Jesus was completely innocent, completely innocent. He had never committed any crime at all. And the stakes were way higher than losing some scholarship, right? But he didn't avoid arrest, and instead he gave himself up. So that is the story we're going to look at today of Jesus's arrest. So this is like, it's probably after midnight. This comes after he's just, you know, we had the episode with Aaron Davis and we talked about the Passover. They were celebrating the Passover in the upper room. And so Jesus spent some time teaching with his disciples and giving them final instructions. And then they leave that upper room. They leave Jerusalem. They go over this little Kidron Brook and they enter the garden. And then there's the scene where Jesus is praying. The disciples are falling asleep. And then like the third time Jesus comes back, he must have heard them coming to arrest him. And it's like nap time is over. And so this is where we're going to enter the scene. So Lindsay, what's going on? Set the scene for us before you read John 18, 1 through 11.
So with John, not just here, but like throughout his book, pay attention to like daytime and nighttime, light and dark, right? So it's nighttime. We know this is nighttime. And that's on purpose. It's like there are things happening in the dark and at night that are not good things, right? Looking at the ravine of Kidron and looking at that, this is the same place where David flees from Absalom, his own son, who betrays him. Yes. And he runs away from Jerusalem, hangs out here, is mourning for Absalom in the Mount of Olives barefoot. This is the same place. And it's probably where he wrote Psalm 3, which is, you know, arise, O Lord, because many are standing and coming against me. Mm-hmm. That's this literal same location with David being betrayed by someone he loved. Jesus is now walking in that valley.
Oh, yeah, that is so good. All right. So would you read this passage for us and then we'll dive in and talk about what's happening here. So John 18, 1 through 11 from the NASB translation.
All right, I'll read it. John 18. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered with his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I'm he." And Judas also, who is betraying him, was standing with them. So when he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore, he said again and asked them, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus said, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these go their way. To fulfill the word which he spoke, of those whom you have given me, I lost not one." Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. And the slave's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put the sword in its sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?"
Thank you. So, Lindsay, let's talk about who's coming after Jesus and how has John put this together?
And the way that John sets it up is it just says they went over this ravine, the Kidron Ravine, and they go to a garden. And like all the other gospel writers, call it the Garden of Gethsemane. You get a setting, but John is so, he's such a storyteller. I feel like so much with John, he's like, I could share anything. So what I've shared with you right now is really important. So I dove into those details.
I love it. And what we know about John is this gospel came much later. He probably wrote it in the 90s and the others were written more like in the 60s, I think, maybe 50s. And so many, many years later, John's an older man. He's had a lot of time to reflect. And I always think it's interesting what John includes that the others don't. And
yes,
there are some details in this text that John includes. And you picture him, I mean, he's on the island of Patmos. He's exiled there. He's got nothing but time. And he is a storyteller and he is constructing this masterful work. And I'm so glad we have it. And so what do you find astonishing though, in the way that he's putting these details together?
I wonder too, if the fact that he just called it a garden, I'm wondering if I should be picking up on Adam. I wondered that because he could have said Garden of Gethsemane, here we go. We know where it is. And he just says generic garden. So now when Jesus comes out, because Adam hid in a garden and Jesus faced it. That's right.
Look at the contrast there. Look at that contrast. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So I feel like John is always trying to, everything that John is giving is on purpose. Where they are is on purpose, that it's a garden. This is the opposite garden experience, right? From Adam. Jesus is going to reverse everything in this garden. And John, I think even visually is setting up, like he says physically where Judas is standing. Like, why would we need to know that? Like, you need to know in your mind that Judas is over on that side. And he was not with us because these guys were friends for 3 years doing everything together. In John 13, when they were all together, nobody knew who was going to betray Jesus. That's how close they were.
Let me just read that verse because that is interesting. I had not put that together. Verse 5, yeah. They answered him, Jesus the Nazarene. And he said to them, I am he. And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really good. But you just threw in some stuff about Adam. I want to go back to that. And then I want to come back to Judas. Like, man, yeah. I got a lot to talk about here. So in the original Garden of Eden, we have a guilty party who is hiding.
Yeah.
And in this scene, we have an innocent man who's stepping out and inviting the arrest, right?
Yeah.
And what else, what other contrasts do you see with those two gardens?
I don't know what time of day it was in Genesis, but they're supposed to be taking a walk with God in the cool of the day.
Yeah.
Which makes you think it is day and this is night. This is nighttime. This is where darkness is starting to seem like it's taking an upper hand and it seems like it's taking control of the situation. And then you have Jesus coming out from hiding out of a garden, like you said, and facing what's happening.
So our second Adam here is choosing this arrest. So let's go back though and look at, so they've crossed the ravine and they're in the garden and we have Judas who's bringing with him this whole Roman cohort. How many soldiers do you think that was?
A Roman cohort is somewhere around 500 people. 500 men. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Okay.
I bet they did hear him coming, right? I mean, yeah.
I never knew that. And it definitely feels like that escalated quickly. Why do you have 500 Roman soldiers coming after this guy?
Does it feel like overkill, right? Like,
no.
Well, and especially because Jesus is stepping out, like, who are you looking for? Right?
But I'm going to go with you. I mean, I think of Beauty and the Beast, you know, they're like grabbing their pitchforks and their hoes and they're like, we're going to go get the beast. Yeah. Quite literally that. It's like, we've got lanterns and torches. We'll light things on fire if we need to. And like weapons.
Today's equivalent would be like a SWAT team with helicopters and machine guns. And there is no hunt. So, all right. So verse 4 says, Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, came out into the open. Yeah, I just love that.
The phrase alone, knowing all the things that were to come upon him. Because I read it and it was like, do you mean all the things? Like crucifixion, like being tortured, like all the things? And Johnson phrasing is, yeah, all the things. All the things that were about to come upon him, he came out in the open. And that was the phrase that made me cue into Adam. Like, just like you're saying, suffering unjustly for things he did not deserve. He came out in the open.
Right. You know? He wasn't hiding, and mm-hmm. nor was he passive. He's actually taking initiative here.
Right.
He's coming toward his captors.
Right.
Showing that, I mean, you know, you look at the story and open theists would say that Jesus just walked into a trap, right? They would say he didn't know, he wasn't mm-hmm. aware. That's just, to me, that just seems ludicrous, because he is either a complete fool walking into a trap or he is completely in control. And everything points to the latter, that he is completely in control, taking initiative here.
Yeah.
I also think it's kind of astonishing that they answer him because he's like, he says, you know, he comes out into the open and says, whom are you seeking? And they answer him, Jesus the Nazarene. So, I mean, does that mean they don't recognize him?
Right. First, Jesus, even in him just asking the question, it's taking initiative on something that's like, who are you looking for? Knowing it's himself.
Yeah.
And then for them to respond, well, we need Jesus the Nazarene. It's like so bizarre. Like, what fugitive is like, who are you guys looking for? And then they go, you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Well, and so I don't know whether they didn't recognize him or they did, but that phrase, Jesus the Nazarene, that isn't the most honoring way to speak of him, right? They don't call him the teacher or the rabbi. They're like, no, this guy from Nazareth. And how does Jesus respond then?
He actually says, I am, which is amazing. The NASB inserts he so we can understand it, but the literal wording is I am, which is so John. Because John is the one who includes all the I am statements about Jesus. I am the bread of life. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the lie. I am. And before Abraham was, I am. And now here he is again. Jesus, the Nazarene, the guy from the small town who we don't like. I am.
Wow. Yeah, it's kind of got a double meaning there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You've just called him Jesus, the guy from this little dinky town, this nobody. I am. Him, but I am the great I am. Like that's the term too, that with Moses and the burning bush, that's what God used.
Yes.
He said, I am. So these are two big words. All right. And then what happens after he says, I am?
This is wild to me. I literally wrote in my notes, what is happening right now? Because he says, I am he. And then they drew back and they fell to the ground. Right. And I was like, what happened? It was amazing to me.
It's astonishing. And this is not just a couple soldiers.
No.
I mean, we're picturing like could be five. I think I read somewhere it could have been up to 1,000, but at least 200, at least 200 soldiers. And they've got their armor, whatever. And I mean, what do you think it sounded like with all, it says,
I mean, you have to hear it go like clonk, 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 clonk. Like it has to have some sound that shields and spears are going down. I mean, what in the world?
This is one of the things that I wonder, why did none of the other gospel writers include this detail?
Was this somewhat involuntary? Like something happened and you were forced to bow, or was something about what Jesus said so compelling that even they were like, but something was obviously happening that is supernatural, that's beyond normal human interaction.
Right.
That, and John was like, you need to know about this.
Yes. And either one of those, I think, would be supernatural. Mm-hmm. If they just fell back involuntarily, I mean, obviously that's supernatural. But even if it's just they suddenly have this like, oh man, this is a powerful person.
Yeah.
And we need to take a step back. And maybe there's this domino effect, like they're all falling all over each other. But I mean, all he said was two words, I am. Mm-hmm. And that would strike terror in their hearts. I mean, that's astonishing either way. But what I noticed too, you know, we fall forward in worship.
Yeah.
They were falling back in fear and intimidation. We fall forward you know, when we're undone by God and His majesty, we fall back when we're overcome by some power. And on, obviously, even though they fall down, they get back up and they arrest the guy, right? Yeah. They didn't just say, all right, I'm out. You know, if you were in that situation, I mean, you would think that there would be some soldiers who would say, like we see the centurions say at the foot of the cross, surely this was the Son of God. You know, you would think they would notice and be like, I'm, you know, I'm on his side. Or at least Judas crossed, like, okay, I've made a terrible mistake here. They don't. And Jesus asks them again, who are you seeking?
Mm-hmm.
And again, they say, same words, Jesus the Nazarene.
Jesus the Nazarene. I wonder too, so many times in John, as he's writing, when he writes these stories, he's making you as the reader do the same thing the characters are participating in. He's sort of forcing you in a decision. He says that about his book. I want to write this so you can believe. Mm. And I was wondering if even in the question, whom are you seeking? It could have just been like, who are you looking for? But I sometimes with his questions, Jesus is like, it's like a double meaning. Like, are you looking for me? Do you want me? Mm. and then obviously that the answer for that side is no, we're not seeking for you that way. But I wondered a little bit in how the question itself was phrased as Jesus put it out there. Whom are you seeking? Who are you looking for in a much bigger, more existential way? And you see this group is not queuing up on who they're actually looking for.
That's very compelling, because for the disciples who are with Jesus, they're like, we're with you to the end. We've bent the knee to you, Jesus. You are our Messiah. And these others, who are you seeking? They're not seeking a Messiah. They're seeking a captor. Right.
Something else. And neither is Judas. This is back to Judas, but in John's narrative, the last time we saw Judas was in John 13. And it's when Jesus shares the bread, but still nobody picks up on it. And then he tells Judas, go ahead and go. And then Judas goes, and it says Judas left, and it was night. It's the last thing we hear about Judas in John 13. Mm-hmm. And then this is where we see him next, betraying Jesus and now standing physically on the side of the Roman cohort. And I feel like narratively with John is letting you know, like, Judas has chosen a side. He's and that's his side in the night.
And we all choose a side, don't we?
Yeah.
We are. And we're either on the side of like the captors, like I've got to put him in his place, or on the side of his disciples where he is my Lord and I bend my knee to him.
Yeah.
We all choose the side, and nobody's in the middle. We can't. That's not an option.
Yeah.
So Jesus gives them another chance.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you looking for? He told them, I am he. Mm-hmm. So if you're seeking me, let these men go on their way. Mm-hmm. And isn't that just beautiful? Jesus is, you know, I just picture, he's so noble. He's so honorable here. He's like, if you're looking for me, those who are on my side, those who are standing with me, let them go. What do you see astonishing there, Lindsay?
I see it's astonishing that he, in this situation, he is protecting them, right? Like, eventually all these men will be martyred, and we know that. But in this moment, this is not that moment. And so Jesus is saying, let them go, because you're here for me. And like, what an incredible, kind, protective move for Jesus to do that. I would imagine if I put myself there, this is my worst nightmare. This is the thing that I've been trying to avoid with Jesus for the last 2 or 3 years that I didn't want to happen.
Well, and protect him from, right? They wanted to protect him from this.
Yeah.
This is not what we wanted.
This is not, we're not wanting to do this. Jesus, I didn't even want to go to Jerusalem right now. And now it's happening. Now the tortures are here and the weapons are here. And now the cohort's here. And this is the thing we're trying to not do. And Jesus is just not fighting, surrendering, and saying, just let them go. And as a disciple, I'm a little bit relieved, like, thanks for saving my life, but it's bewildering. It's like, we're not going to fight them. We're not going to resist them. You're not going to call down fire. Like, are we done? Like, I know you're protecting me and sending me away, but like, what am I supposed to do now?
Well, and they know that he's got all this power at his disposal. Like, what are you going to do? You're not going to do something.
You're not going to just obliterate these guys? Like, what? called. Yeah.
Yeah. Call down the fire. Right. This is your moment. Take the throne. That right.
My idea is call down the fire. That is so me. And it's cool that John wants us to understand, like, Jesus was doing this to fulfill something he just spoke.
Yeah.
So now, like, Jesus's words from the chapter before are starting to carry the weight of prophecy fulfilled, mm-hmm. of Jesus saying, I didn't lose anyone that the Father gave me. And John seeing that is Jesus kept his word. Jesus kept his words.
He did. Yes. He just said that. And he also, back in John 10, let me just read these verses. John 10, 28, he said, This is the scene where Jesus healed the blind man, and then he comes and he worships Jesus, and Jesus is explaining, like, this guy, he's one of my sheep. He knows my voice. Mm-hmm. At the end of the story, they want to stone him. But Jesus says in verse 28, you do not believe because you're not part of my flock. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them. They follow me, and I give them eternal life, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. And then Jesus goes on and he talks about how he's the good shepherd and he lays down his life and nobody takes his sheep. And he has the authority to lay it down. And I just wonder if, like, John is pointing to the fact here that Jesus told us that's going to happen. And this is all being fulfilled here. Right. I love that. I love that. This is our good shepherd being the good shepherd. He is shepherding. He is stepping out in front. I would almost kind of picture him with the disciples. He's stepping out in front of them. Do you think they're hovering back in the darkness, or, you know, maybe inching?
I think maybe some of them are probably okay to be behind, but I have a feeling at least some, and Peter was more in a, like, I will punch my way out of this. you, Jesus, I'll do it.
And but, that's kind of what we see him doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's go to that part. Simon Peter, since he had a sword, he drew it and he struck the high priest slave, Malchus, cuts off his ear. And I wonder, Lindsay, do you think the soldiers are still getting up at that point? Are they still on the ground? And does he see an opportunity, like, oh, they're down, I'm going to go.
I'm going to go after this poor guy who's the high priest slave. Like, why don't you kill someone who has some actual power, Peter? He doesn't even do that. He tries to go for some poor slave, and he doesn't kill the guy. He just takes his ear off, which means maybe he wasn't too good with a sword. You know, not too good of a shot there.
Yeah, Peter. He's a fisher dude. So, you know,
he's like, I don't know. I did have a moment where it was like, Simon Peter, since he had a sword, and I was like, I just feel like John's digging a little at Peter, because he likes to do that. Just a little bit. Peter brought his sword to the prayer meeting. And of course, Peter brought a sword to the prayer meeting and used it on the poor high priest slave. I mean, we joke now, but the specific, like, he says, the right ear of the high priest slave Malchus. It's like, well, John, that's a lot of details for this moment. But it's a weird, it's classic Peter, because it's a weird, violent reaction in the moment that Peter is so known for, which usually comes out of his mouth. And God love him. You're just like, Peter, it's still off. I love you. Still off.
He's always got these big emotional responses, and I just love him for it, because I have this big emotional personality too. And I love that about him. But you're right. It's a little off here, Peter. Mm-hmm. You're going to take on all of them, and you're starting with, I love that you pointed out, starting with the slave. Do you think the slave had no weapon?
High priest seems like it's the high priest slave. Poor guy went out there to do what he's supposed to do and gets his ear cut off. He doesn't seem armed. Who knows? Doesn't look like anyone got Peter back, but seems like a weird choice for Peter to do that.
It does. Yeah. And then Jesus responds. We don't see it in this text. John doesn't include the detail that Jesus does heal the guy's ear.
Right. Yeah.
But what does Jesus say to Peter there?
He says, Peter, put your sword away, put it back in the sheath. And this is, to me, this is huge. This is everything about the movement of this text. the cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? And that's his reason.
What is astonishing there? What do we see in Jesus here?
I am astonished by the surrender to the will of the Father when he knows, obviously we saw that from verse 4, knowing all the things that were about to come upon him, he's saying, this is a rhetorical question, am I not going to do what the Father gave me to do? So he's been doing through the whole book of John. I only do what I see the Father doing. I only do what the Father tells me. And now here, in this really difficult moment, same response. Would I not drink the cup the Father's given me? Of course I will. It's astonishing because it means enormous pain for him. Enormous pain for him.
Yes, it's a culminating moment. Mm-hmm. He is determined. The cup is often, it's a metaphor for drinking down God's wrath, his judgment. And I like that metaphor because it's not something passive. If you're going to drink something, I mean, I picture my little kids like, when I would make them drink their milk and they didn't want to drink their milk, and they'd be like, oh, you know, drinking it down. Like you can't be passive and drink something that you don't want to drink. Right. Or a better, when they would drink their medicine, you know, they didn't want their medicine, something bitter. And that is surrender. You know, I've talked a lot in the past about control and surrender. And we often think of surrender as this passive thing, you know, it's like, it's not doing something. Right. But I disagree. I think surrender is gritty and uphill, and it is the heart. It's the drinking down, the choice to do something active, like receiving something you don't want. And this is the culmination of Jesus's surrender. It's all, well, I mean, actually I take that back, because we see Jesus until his dying breath. We see him surrendering with each choice and each breath and each word. He is surrendering to the will of the Father, very actively denying himself, laying down his life.
Yeah. And Peter uses the language there in 1 Peter. He kept entrusting himself to the to his faithful creator. Like that, even that verb, kept entrusting himself, like this continual movement over and over of surrender. And the surrender wasn't passive for Jesus. Surrendering meant carrying across to the city, and surrendering meant being flogged, and surrendering meant being crucified and dying in that way. And that wasn't passive for him, especially considering what power he had at his disposal and chose not to access at all.
Right. This is, I mean, in season one of this podcast, we talked about all these amazing, I mean, Jesus could calm a storm. Jesus could raise someone from the dead. Jesus could stop. I mean, he had immense power and he did not have to do anything. Nobody took his life from him. He laid it down. He laid it down.
Yeah.
And he protected his own in the process. I love that tenderness mixed with, like, there's just such nobility. Jesus deserves our worship. Does he not?
Oh yeah. One of the things that as I was reading this, I'm usually looking for what's one handle that I can, what is the nucleus of this? What is all this centering around? For me, I thought of it as just this play on, like, who's in control in this movement? Who's powerful in this passage? Because you start off with Jesus and his people coming in, and then it intros with Judas got all these people. Judas got a Roman cohort, and Judas got these officials. So then you're like, is Judas in control? Because he just somehow wrangled up hundreds of people. Is the Roman cohort in control? Because they're terrifying. Are the chief priests and the officers in control? Now, is Peter's vying for control? Like, he's trying to control it? Like, he's like, I'm going to single-handedly turn this thing around. And to me, that very last sentence shows you who's in control. The Father's in control, because he's giving this moment to the Son, and the Son is in control because he's willing to receive it. He doesn't say the Father forced me this cup. The Father gave it to the Son. And then, like you said, with medicine, the Son took it, which is remarkable that really the people in charge here are the Father and the Son and not actually anyone else, not Judas or the cohort, not even Peter, not any of them. The Father and the Son have this moment.
This is fully in control. And the implications are for us, because they are in control. This isn't happening to Jesus. This is all part of a plan to save you and me. And aren't you so glad that it's not at the hands of, I mean, if we were betting people, we would probably put our bets on the cohort. Like, they got all the swords, right?
This is the work of the Father and the Son saying yes to that work for our sakes.
And I mean, I just want to call attention to surrender is the place of power. Because mm-hmm. when we are most surrendered, we have the most power of the Spirit at our disposal.
Yeah.
So Jesus goes first and lays mm-hmm. his life down and invites us to come and follow and do the same. So Lindsay, let me ask you, what would it look like, first of all, to live like this story isn't true, that this all just mm-hmm. happened to mm-hmm. Jesus, that this is a calamity coming to him. Mm-hmm. What would it look like to live like this story isn't true?
Mm-hmm. We have, there's a lot of false narratives in my own life and in our lives that we're living from a base assumption of a story that's not true. And to live like this is not true is, I think, to look at your own life and the things that happen in your life as is either outside of the control of God and outside of, and maybe you're willing to embrace it's his control, but you're not yet at a place where you can see that he's also good and can bring good. And so to live like this isn't true is to see your life as either God doesn't know what's happening. He's obviously not in control of what's happening. If he is in control, he isn't good. He can't bring good from this. And viewing our lives or even just the circumstances around us is beyond his reach and beyond his goodness and his kindness.
Yeah, it's like the picture that we see of Peter. Like we just rise up with our little dagger and try to, take a stab at something. Like it's out right. of my control, as if God right. isn't in control. So have you ever, do you have anything from your own life where you've ever
it's like, well, pick one. Right in the thousand little ways a day that you're surrendering. But two for me that I can think of. Miscarriage and infertility is a big part of my story. Mm-hmm. And when we had tried for 2 years to get pregnant and then I got pregnant and then I miscarried. And it was like, are you kidding me? You cannot tell me that any of this is good, that I depended on you for 2 years in prayer. We believed that you would do the impossible. And then I was pregnant and then you took it away. And at that point, it was such a crucial moment of faith of in bad and things that are lost and difficult to even reconcile. Who do you believe that he is? Because either he can bring good and he is good or he isn't. And you have to face it.
That's so good. I just want to interject. I see a little parallel there with these disciples. They're like, we thought something good, like what we had craved for, the Messiah is here. You can't take him away from us. Like, how dare you give us hope?
We thought this was the kingdom. This right, was it.
Right.
You're going to restore Israel. We're going to get the land back. You're going to kick up this is the revolution. Like, this is the thing. Right. And right. then Jesus willingly goes with the soldiers and dismisses the disciples. And it's like, just let them go. And it's like, this is not what we thought was unfolding right now at all. Right.
So whether it's on a grand scale, a national level, or whether it's a baby or whether it's a job, living like this isn't true is acting as though nobody's in control. And we got to rise up and with our little dagger and fight back the darkness. But what does it look like to live as though this story actually is true?
Mm-hmm. I think it means exactly what you said. It's an active surrender. And I think surrender it's okay for surrender to happen every 5 minutes, if that's what you need. If you every 5 minutes need to again go, I started to think again, I was in control. I surrender again. I surrender again for the next 5 minutes. I have felt that. I have felt like the battle being so intense inside of me that I so didn't like the circumstance that truly it was like, I can trust you for the next 5 minutes to remember that you're in control of this. And I don't have to be, and I'm not. And the better, the more powerful work is that you are in control and I can trust you to bring good out of this. It's mm-hmm. that active surrender to him constantly.
That's so good. Yeah. In my book, Control Girl, the subtitle is Lessons on Surrendering Your Burden of Control from 7 Women in the Bible. When I finished writing about these 7 women, I'm like, said to my publisher, we got to have another chapter because we now live in the age of the Spirit. Like these women didn't have the Spirit, but mm-hmm. we got to talk about surrendering control to the spirit who is within us. He who is in us is greater. And so I talked about how, you know, I know women who would say, I've given God my life. I surrender control to him, you know, and I've surrendered some really big stuff like infertility or losing someone or some, you know, having to move and I didn't want to move, like these really big, you know, like laying your Isaac on the altar kind of moments. Mm-hmm. I know some women who've done that, but then they, the rest of the time in between these big moments of surrender, they live like they're the ones in control. And I think the most transformative surrender is like what you're just saying. Mm-hmm. It's in 5 minute intervals.
Yeah.
Of I'm going to surrender again and again and again. Like just take something like infertility. Like let's say one of our listeners is struggling with infertility, like you did. What if you take that big mountain of infertility and you take it just a spoonful of dirt at a time? Exactly. I surrender. Yes. Like every 5 minutes, do you think that changes us?
I can say it changes you because it changed me. Yeah. It changed me like so much. So when Paul talks about life in the spirit, it's in very surrendered words, be led by the spirit, walk in the spirit, walk with the spirit. Those are all very like, if I'm trying to take a walk with you, Shannon, arm in arm, I have to be really close to you and like defer to like, what is your pace? What's your steps that I want to be with you in steps? If I'm going to be led by somebody, if I was going to be led by you, like I have to surrender something and be responsive to your movement, not my own. And all of that is true, even in our suffering and surrendering to Jesus, like moment by moment. I was changed because the mountain for me of infertility in that scenario and potentially never having biological children and what that would feel like and what that would do. It was all, it truly was too overwhelming. Sometimes you're just taking on the next year of your life. You don't know what that is. That's too overwhelming for me. And I mean, healing did start with, I really believe that God moved in my life as I prayed and said, what am I supposed to do with all this pain that I feel? Like storms of pain. And I just genuinely felt him say, stay under this. And I said, I can't do that. And yet what became a tangible practice was sometimes every 5 minutes, sometimes every few hours, literally having my hands out and saying, help me stay under this because I want to run. I want to do something. I don't know what I do. I just don't want to be here enduring this. Mm-hmm. I want to escape it somehow. He gave me strength for the next 5 minutes. And then I did it again. I can't endure this. Another wave of sorrow. Can you help me? And it wasn't instantaneous, but that movement over time did bring me out of the dark and grew the treasure of endurance. I mean, the importance of just endurance was grown just by having a weak moment every 5 minutes saying, I can't surrender to this thing. Mm. And he sustained me in it. And it that continues to train me. So in 2020, I was doing women's ministry. I loved it. I was like, this is my favorite job I've ever had. It was awesome. And then I had a COVID baby, a sweet, chubby COVID baby. But I had to quit my job. I was like, I wish I could do my job before kids. I can't do that. And it was a massive surrender for me. It was so hard. I cried so many tears. And it was that movement in infertility of, this is not the circumstance I thought of. This isn't what I wanted to do. This feels really painful. And yet it was that training that in the moment of now having a baby, I wasn't anticipating. Isn't that ironic? It was like, Lindsay, you know what to do. Surrender every 5 minutes if that's what you've got. So that's what I did. Every 5 minutes when it felt painful, it was, God, this is not what I was expecting. Help me endure it. And that's what shaped me.
Oh, that's so good. And shaped you into the image of Jesus.
How incredible that our Savior, like when I'm telling him, I am struggling with what you've chosen for me. This is really hard for me. He says back to us, I know, me too.
Yeah.
What? He doesn't say, I don't know what that's like. He's like, right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And all of the strength of Jesus in this story, the endurance. Yeah. So, and Lindsay, we're going to link to your book on infertility and my book, my Bible study on control. And so, you know, I just want to close by saying, what a beautiful story of our God who surrendered to his Father.
Yeah.
And yeah, we can too. In his, yeah, in his power, in his strength, we can be conformed to this image of Jesus, yeah, and we can live these surrendered, beautiful lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me for this amazing conversation, Lindsay.
Thank you so much. I had so much fun. It was great.
Have you been living according to one of those false narratives that Lindsay mentioned? Have you been living as though God obviously is out of control, that the circumstances in your life are beyond his reach, or that if he's in control, this bad thing couldn't have happened, or he couldn't possibly bring good from it? Friend, will you spend some time looking at Jesus in this story and reminding yourself he was in control and he went to the cross, and that was very, very good. This is the true narrative. It corrects all of our false assumptions. And the question is, are we going to live like the story is true? Come check the show notes for a link to Lindsay Schott's co-authored book, Trying: Reflections on Faith Through Infertility, Miscarriage, and Loss. I'd also love for you to check out my 9-week study, Control Girl: Lessons on Surrendering Your Burden of Control from 7 Women in the Bible. There's a link for you there, or go to controlgirl.com. Are you enjoying this true story of Easter series? I sure hope so. If so, I'd love for you to share it with a friend or leave a rating or a review. This helps others to be able to find the podcast. Don't forget to grab your Live Like It's True workbook. I'd love to hear how that is working for you. Well, thanks so much for joining me. And now it's time to go live like it's true.